They all fell silent, gazing at Father Aeneas, and he began to speak from his raised couch. O Queen, the sorrow you bid me bring to life again is past all words. The destruction by the Greeks of the wealth of Troy, and of the kingdom that will be mourned for ever, and all the horrors I have seen, and in which I played a large part. No man could speak of such things and not weep. None of the Myrmidons of Achilles, or the Dolopians of Neoptolemus, not even a follower of Ulysses, a man not prone to pity. Besides, the dewy night is already falling fast from the sky, and the setting stars are speaking to us of sleep. But if you have such a great desire to know what we suffered, to hear in brief about the last agony of Troy, although my mind recoiled in anguish when you asked, and I shudder to remember, I shall begin. Year after year, the leaders of the Greeks had been broken in war and denied by the fates, until, with the aid of the divine skill of Pallas Athene, they built a horse the size of a mountain, cutting pine trees to weave into it for ribs. They pretended it was a votive offering for their safe return to Greece, and that was the story on men's lips. Then they chose some men by lot from their best warriors, and shut them up in the darkness of its belly, filling the vast cavern of its womb with armed soldiers. Within sight of the mainland is the island of Tenedos, famous in story. While the kingdom of Priam stood, it was rich and prosperous, but now there is only a bay, giving a none-too-safe anchorage for ships. The Greeks sailed here and took cover on its lonely shore. We thought they had left us and sailed for Mycenae with favouring winds. The whole of Troy then shook itself free of its long sorrow. The gates were thrown open and the people went out rejoicing to see the Greek encampment, the deserted shore, and all the places abandoned by the enemy. Here was the Dolopian camp, and here fierce Achilles had his tent. This was where the fleet was drawn up. This was where they used to fight their battles. Some gazed at the fatal offering to the virgin goddess Minerva and marvelled at the huge size of the horse. Thymoetes was the first to urge them to drag it inside their walls and set it on their citadel. Whether it was treachery that made him speak, or whether the fates of Troy were already moving towards that end. But Capys and those of sounder judgment did not trust this offering. They thought it was some trick of the Greeks and should be thrown into the sea or set fire to and burned, or that they should bore holes in its hollow belly and probe for hiding places. The people were uncertain and their passions were divided. Then suddenly, at the head of a great throng, Laocoon came running down in a blaze of fury from the heights of the citadel, shouting from a distance as he came, "Oh, you poor fools, are you out of your minds, you Trojans? Do you seriously believe that your enemies have sailed away? Do you imagine Greeks ever give gifts without some devious purpose? Is this all you know about Ulysses? I tell you, there are Greeks hiding in here, shut up in all this wood. Or else it is a siege engine designed for use against our walls to spy on our homes and come down on the city from above. Or else there is some other trick we cannot see. Do not trust the horse, Trojans. Whatever it is, I am afraid of Greeks, particularly when they bring gifts." With these words, he threw a great spear with all his strength into the beast's side, into the curved timbers of its belly. It stuck there vibrating. The creature's womb quivered, and the hollow caverns boomed and groaned. If divine fate, if the minds of the gods had not been set against us, Laocoon would surely have forced us to tear open the hiding places of the Greeks with our swords. Troy would still be standing, and the high citadel of Priam would still be in its place. While this was going on, there was a sudden outcry, and some Trojan shepherds came before the king, dragging a man with his hands tied behind his back. They knew nothing about him. They had come upon him, and he had given himself up. This was all part of his scheme. His purpose was to open Troy to the Greeks. He knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he was ready for either outcome, to spin his web or to meet certain death if he failed. In their eagerness to see the prisoner, Trojan soldiers came running up from all sides and gathered round to join in jeering at him. Listen now to this story of Greek treachery, and from this one indictment, learn the ways of a whole people. Dishevelled and defenceless, he stood there with every eye upon him, looking all round him at the warriors of Troy, and said with a great sigh, "There is nowhere for me now, on sea or land. There is nothing left for a man like me, who has no place among the Greeks. And now, here are my enemies, the Trojans, baying for my blood." He groaned. We had a change of heart, and all our passions were checked. We fell to asking him what his family was, and what he had come to tell us. We wanted to hear why he had allowed himself to be taken prisoner. "O King Priam," he replied, "I am the sort of man who will confess the whole truth to you, whatever it may be. First of all, I am a Greek from Argos, and I will not deny it. Fortune may have made Sinome an object of pity, but for all her malice, she will never make him a cheat or a liar. You may perhaps have heard tell of the name of Palamedes, son of Belus, and the great glory that was his. Although he was innocent, false information was infamously laid against him. His offence was that he objected to the war, and the Greeks put him to death. They murdered him, and now they mourn him. This Palamedes was my comrade and my kinsman. My father was a poor man and sent me here to the war to be with him from my earliest years. While Palamedes was secure in his kingship and had authority in the council of the kings, we too had some standing and some credit. But after he left the shores of this upper world, the victim of the jealousy of Ulysses and his smooth tongue, you all know about Ulysses, I was prostrate and dragged out my life in darkness and grief, brooding to myself over the downfall of my innocent friend, till, like a madman, I broke my silence and promised that I would miss no chance of revenge if ever I came back in victory to our native Argos. My words roused his bitter hatred. This was my first step on a slippery path. From this moment on, Ulysses kept me in a constant state of fear by one new accusation after another. From this moment on, he spread vague rumours about me among the common soldiers. He knew he was guilty and was looking for weapons to use against me. Nor did he rest until, with Calchas the priest as his lackey. But why do I waste time? Why go over all this sordid story to no purpose? If, in your eyes, all Greeks are the same, and all you have to know is that a man is a Greek, then give me my punishment. It is long overdue. This would please Ulysses, our friend from Ithaca, and Agamemnon and Menelaus would pay you well for it. By this time, we were burning to ask questions and find out why all this had happened. We had never met villainy on this scale before. We were not familiar with the arts of Greece. He went on with his lies, cringing with fear as he spoke. The Greeks have often wanted to make their escape from here and leave Troy far behind them, abandoning this long and weary war. And oh, how I wish they had done so. But again and again, rough seas here kept them in port, or the south wind alarmed them as they were setting sail. And most of all, when this construction of interwoven maple beams, this horse, was at last in position here, the black clouds thundered all round the sky. We were at a loss, and sent Eurypylus to consult the oracle of Phoebus Apollo. And this is the grim response he brought back from the shrine. When you Greeks first came to Troy, you killed a virgin and appeased the winds with her blood. This was Iphigenia. With blood, you must find a way to return. You must sacrifice a Greek life. When this answer came to people's ears, they did not know where to turn, and the cold fear ran through the marrow of their bones. For whom were they to prepare death? Whom did Apollo want? At this point, there was a great uproar, and the Ithacan dragged out the prophet Calchas into the middle of us and demanded to know what was the will of the gods. Many people could detect even then the ruthless hand of the schemer directed against me. They saw what was to come and held their peace. For 10 days, Calchas gave no answer, concealing himself and refusing to say the word that would betray a man and send him to his death. But at long last, all according to plan, he allowed the clamour raised by the Ithacan to force him to break his silence and mark me out for the altar. They all agreed. They had all been afraid, but now one man was doomed, and this they could endure. The day of the abomination was soon upon us. The sacred rites were all prepared for me. The salted meal was sprinkled, and the sacrificial ribbons were round my head. I escaped from death, I admit it. I broke my bonds and lay hidden all night in the reeds of a marsh, waiting for them to set sail, and wondering if they had. I have no hope now of seeing the land which was once my home, or my beloved children, or my father, whom I have so often longed for. Perhaps they will be punished for my escape, and wash away this guilt of mine with their own helpless blood. But I beg of you, by the gods who know the truth, by any honesty that may survive unsullied between men, pity me in my great suffering. I know in my heart I have not deserved it. He wept. We spared him, and even began to pity him. King Priam spoke first, and ordered him to be freed from the manacles and the ropes that tied him, and spoke these friendly words. Whoever you are, from this moment on, forget the Greeks whom you have lost. You will be one of us. But now, give full and truthful answers to the questions I ask you. Why have they set up this huge monster of a horse? Who proposed it? What is the purpose of it? Does it have some supernatural power? Is it an engine of war? Sinon was ready with all his Greek arts and stratagems. Raising to the skies the hands we had just freed from their shackles, he cried, "I call upon you, eternal fires of heaven, and your inviolable Godhead." That means the stars. "I call upon the altars and the impious swords from which I have escaped. I call upon the sacred ribbons which I wore, a sacrificial victim. It is no sin for me to break my sacred oaths of allegiance to the Greeks. It is no sin for me to hate these men and bring all their secrets out into the open. I am no longer subject to the laws of my people. Only you must stand by your promises. If I keep Troy safe, Troy must keep its word and save me. If what I say is true, and what I offer is a full and fair exchange." All the hopes and confidence of the Greeks in this war they started have always depended upon the help of Pallas Athene. But ever since the impious Diomede and Ulysses, the schemer behind all their crimes, took it upon themselves to tear the fateful Palladium, the image, the statue of the goddess, from her own sacred temple in Troy, ever since they slew the guards on the heights of the citadel and dared to touch the sacred bands on the head of the virgin goddess with blood on their hands, from that moment their hopes turned to water and ebbed away from them. Their strength was broken, and the mind of the goddess was set against them. Tritonian Pallas gave clear signs of this by sending portents that could not be doubted. No sooner had they laid down the image in the Greek camp than its eyes glared and flashed fire. The salt sweat streamed over its limbs, and by some miracle, the image of the goddess leapt three times from the ground with her shield and spear quivering. Calchas declared that they had to take instant flight across the sea and prophesied that Troy could not be sacked by Argive weapons unless they first took the omens again in Argos in Greece and then brought back to Troy the divine image which they have now carried away across the sea on their curved ships. So now they have all set sail for their native Mycenae, to rearm and to muster their gods to come with them. And they will soon remeasure the ocean and be back here when you least expect them. This is how Calchas interprets the omens, and on his advice, they have set up this effigy of a horse to atone for the violation of the Palladium and the divinity of Pallas, and for their deadly sin of sacrilege. But he told them to make it an immense structure of interlaced timbers soaring to the sky, so that it could not be taken through the gates and brought into the city, or protect the people should they receive it with their traditional piety. For if your hands violate this offering to Minerva, then total destruction shall fall upon the empire of Priam. And the Trojans, and may the gods rather send that on his own head. But if your hands raise it up into your city, Asia shall come unbidden in a mighty war to the walls of Pelops. That means Troy will go over to Greece making war. And that is the fate in store for our descendants. The trap was laid. These were the arts of the liar Sinon, and we believed it all. Cunning and false tears had overcome the men who had not been subdued by Diomede, son of Tydeus, nor Achilles of Larissa, not by 10 years of siege, nor 1,000 ships. And now there came upon this unhappy people another and yet greater sign, which caused them even greater fear. Their hearts were troubled, and they could not see what the future held. Laocoon, the chosen priest of Neptune, was sacrificing a huge bull at the holy altar, when suddenly there came over the calm water from Tenedos, I shudder at the memory of it, two serpents leaning into the sea in great coils and making side by side for the shore. Breasting the waves, they held high their blood-stained crests, and the rest of their bodies ploughed the waves behind them, their backs winding coil upon measureless coil through the sounding foam of the sea. Now they were on land. Their eyes were blazing and flecked with blood. They hissed as they licked their lips with quivering tongues. We grew pale at the sight and ran in all directions, but they made straight for Laocoon. First, the two serpents seized his two young sons, twining round them both and feeding on their helpless limbs. Then, when Laocoon came to the rescue with his sword in his hand, they seized him and bound him in huge spirals, and soon their scaly backs were entwined twice round his body and twice round his throat, their heads and necks high above him, as he struggled to prise open their coils, his priestly ribbons befouled by gore and black venom. And all the time he was raising horrible cries to heaven, like the bellowing of a wounded bull shaking the ineffectual axe out of its neck as it flees from the altar. But the two snakes escaped, gliding away to the highest temples of the city, and making for the citadel of the heartless Pallas, the Tritonian goddess Minerva, where they sheltered under her feet and under the circle of her shield. Now, for that section on Laocoon, you should also look at the website www.pyrrha.me.uk and the Roman poetry section. There's a big section there on the Laocoon story. Anyway, back to the book. At that moment, a new fear crept into all their trembling hearts. They said that Laocoon had been justly punished for his crime. He had violated the sacred timbers by hurling his sinful spear into the horse's back, and they all shouted together that it should be taken to a proper place and prayers offered up to the goddess. We breached the walls and laid open the buildings of our city. They all buckled to the task, setting wheels to roll beneath the horse's feet and stretching ropes of flax to its neck. The engine of fate mounted our walls, teeming with armed men. Unmarried girls and boys sang their hymns round it, and rejoiced to have a hand on the rope. On it came, gliding smoothly, looking down on the heart of the city. Oh, my native land! Oh, Ilium, home of the gods! Oh, walls of the people of Dardanus, famous in war! Four times it stopped on the very threshold of the gate, and four times the armour clanged in its womb. But we paid no heed, and pressed on blindly, madly, and stood the accursed monster on our consecrated citadel. Even at this last moment, Cassandra was still opening her lips to foretell the future. But God had willed that these were lips the Trojans would never believe. This was the last day of a doomed people, and we spent it adorning the shrines of the gods all through the city with festal garlands. Meanwhile, the sky was turning and night was rushing up from the ocean to envelop in its great shadow the earth, the sky, and the treachery of the Greeks, while the Trojans were lying quiet in their homes, their weary bodies wrapped in sleep. The Greek fleet, in full array, was already taking the army from Tenedos through the friendly silence of the moon and making for the shore they knew so well, when the royal flagship raised high the fire signal, and Sinon, preserved by the cruelty of the divine fates, stealthily undid the pine bolts of the horse and freed the Greeks from its womb. The wooden horse was open, and the Greeks were pouring gratefully out of its hollow chambers into the fresh air. The commanders, Thesandrus and Sthenelus, and fierce Ulysses, sliding down the rope they had lowered, and with them Acamas, Thoas, Neoptolemus of the line of Peleus, Machaon, who came out first, Menelaus, and Epeius himself, the maker of the horse that tricked the Trojans. They moved into a city buried in wine and sleep, slaying the guards and opening the gates to let in all their waiting comrades and join forces as they had planned. It was the time when rest, the most grateful gift of the gods, was first beginning to creep over suffering mortals, when Hector suddenly appeared before my eyes in my sleep, full of sorrow and streaming with tears. He looked as he did when he had been dragged behind the chariot, black with dust and caked with blood, his feet swollen where they had been pierced for the leather thongs. What a sight he was! How changed from the Hector who had thrown Trojan fire onto the ships of the Greeks, or come back clad in the spoils of Achilles. His beard was filthy, his hair matted with blood, and he had on his body all the wounds he had received around the walls of his native city. In my dream, I spoke to him first, forcing out my words, and I too was weeping and full of sorrow. O light of Troy, best hope and trust of all Trojans, what has kept you so long from us? Long have we waited for you, Hector. From what shores have you come? With what eyes do we look upon you in our weariness, after the death of so many of your countrymen, after all the sufferings of your people and your city? What has so shamefully disfigured the face that was once so serene? What wounds are these I see? There was no reply. He paid no heed to my futile questions, but heaved a great groan from the depths of his heart and said, "You must escape, son of the goddess. You must save yourself from these flames. The enemy is master of the walls, and Troy is falling from her highest pinnacle. You have given enough to your native land and to Priam. If any right hand could have saved Troy, mine would have saved it. Into your care she now commends her sacraments and her household gods. Take them to share your fate. Look for a great city to establish for them after long wanderings across the sea." These were his words, and he brought out in his own hands from her inmost shrine the mighty goddess Vesta, that's a statue, with the sacred ribbons on her head and her undying flame. Meanwhile, the city was in utter confusion and despair. Although the house of my father Anchises stood apart and was screened by trees, the noise was beginning to be heard, and the din of battle was coming closer and closer. I shook the sleep from me and climbed to the top of the highest gable of the roof and stood there with my ears pricked up, like a shepherd when a furious south wind is carrying fire into a field of grain, or a mountain river whirls along in spate, flattening all the fields, the growing crops and all the labour of oxen, carrying great trees headlong down in its floods, while the shepherd stands stupefied on the top of the rock, listening to the sound without knowing what it is. Then, in that moment, I knew the truth. The treacherous scheming of the Greeks was there to see. Soon, the great house of Deiphobus yielded to the flames and fell in ruins. Soon, his neighbour, Eucalagone, was burning, and the broad waters of the Strait of Sigeum reflected the flames. The clamour of men and the clangour of trumpets rose to high heaven. Mindlessly, I put on my armour, for reason had little use for armour, but my heart was burning to gather comrades for battle and rush to the citadel with them. Frenzy and anger drove me on, and suddenly it seemed a noble thing to die in arms. I now caught sight of Panthus, just escaped from the weapons of the Greeks. Panthus, son of Othrys, priest of Apollo and of the citadel. He was carrying in his hands the sacraments and the defeated gods from the temple, and dragging his young grandson along behind him in a mad rush to the door of my father's house. Where is our strong point? Where are we rallying? I had scarcely time to speak before he replied, groaning, "The last day has come for the people of Dardanus. This is the hour they cannot escape. The Trojans are no more. Ilium has come to an end, and with it the great glory of the race of Teucer. Pitiless Jupiter has given everything over to Argos. The Greeks are masters of the burning city. The horse stands high in the heart of it, pouring out its armed men, and Sinon is in triumph, spreading the flames and gloating over us. The great double gates are open, and Greeks are there in their thousands, as many as ever came from great Mycenae. Others have blocked the narrow streets with their weapons levelled. Their lines are drawn up, and the naked steel is flashing, ready for slaughter. Only the first few guards on the gates are trying to fight and offering blind resistance. I went where I was driven by the words of Panthus and the will of the gods into the fighting and the flames, where the grim fury of war called me, where I could hear the din of battle and the shouts rising to heaven. I came across Ripius in the moonlight, and Epitus, huge in his armour, and they threw in their lot with me. Hipparnes and Dymas too came to my side, and so did Corybus, son of Mygdon. He had happened to come to Troy just in these last few days, burning with mad love for Cassandra, and was fighting as son-in-law on the side of Priam and the Trojans. It was his misfortune not to heed the advice his bride had given him in her prophetic frenzy. When I saw them standing shoulder to shoulder and spoiling for battle, I addressed them in these words. You are the bravest of all our warriors, and your bravery is in vain. If your desire is fixed to follow a man who fights to the end, you see how things stand with us. All the gods on whom this empire once depended have left their shrines and their altars. You are rushing to defend a burning city. Let us die. Let us rush into the thick of the fighting. The one safety for the defeated is to have no hope of safety. These words added madness to their courage. From that moment, like wolves foraging blindly on a misty night, driven out of their lairs by a ravening hunger that gives them no rest, and leaving their young behind to wait for them with their throats all dry, we ran the gauntlet of the enemy to certain death, holding our course through the middle of the city with the hollow blackness of dark night hanging over us. Who could unfold the horrors of that night? Who could speak of such slaughter? Who could weep tears to match that suffering? It was the fall of an ancient city that had long ruled an empire. The bodies of the dead lay through all its streets and houses and the sacred shrines of its gods. Nor was it only Trojans who paid their debts in blood. Sometimes valour came back even to the hearts of the defeated, and Greeks were cut down in their hour of triumph. Bitter grief was everywhere. Everywhere there was fear and death in many forms. The first of the Greeks to come to meet us was Androgeus, and he had a large contingent of men with him. Not knowing who we were, but thinking we were allies, he called out first to us, "Move along there, friends. Why are you so slow? What's keeping you back? The citadel is on fire, and everyone else is pillaging and plundering. Have you just arrived from your tall ships?" He spoke, and when no convincing answer came, he instantly realised that he had fallen amongst enemies. He was stupefied and started backwards without another word. He was like a man going through rough briars who steps on a snake with all his weight without seeing it and starts back in sudden panic as it raises its wrath and puffs up its blue-green neck. That is how Androgeus recoiled in terror at the sight of us. We fell upon them and surrounded them with a wall of weapons. They did not know the ground and were stricken with fear, so we cut them down wherever we caught them. Fortune gave us a fair wind for our first efforts, and Coroebus, his spirits raised by our success, cried out, "Come, comrades, let us take the first road fortune shows us to safety, and go where she shows that she approves. Let us change shields with the Greeks and put on their insignia. Is this treachery, or is it courage? Who would ask in dealing with an enemy? The Greeks themselves will provide our armour." He spoke, and then put on the plumed helmet of Androgeus, and his richly blazoned shield, and buckled the Greek sword to his side. Ripius cheerfully followed suit, then Dymas himself and the whole band. Every man armed himself with the spoils he had just taken, and moving through the city, we mingled with the Greeks, and fought many battles under gods not our own, clashing blindly in the night. And many a Greek did we send down to Orcus. Some scattered towards their ships, running for the safety of the shore. Some climbed back in abject fear into the huge horse and hid themselves in its familiar belly. But no man can put trust in gods who are opposed to him. Suddenly, there was Cassandra, the maiden daughter of Priam, being dragged from the temple of Minerva, from her very sanctuary, with hair streaming and her burning eyes raised in vain to heaven. But only her eyes, they had tied her gentle hands. Coroebus could not endure the sight of this, but a wild frenzy took him, and he hurled himself into the middle of the enemy to his death. We all went after him and ran upon their spears where they were thickest. First, we were attacked by our own men and overwhelmed by their missiles thrown from the high gable of the temple roof, and the sight of our armour and the confusion caused by our Greek crests brought pitiable slaughter on us. Then the Greeks raised furious alarm at the rescue of Cassandra and gathered from every quarter to attack us, Ajax fiercest of them all, the two sons of Atreus, that's Agamemnon and Menelaus, and the whole army of the Dolopians. It was as though a whirlwind had burst and opposing winds were clashing, the west, the south, and the east wind glorying in the horses of the morning, with woods wailing and wild Nereus churning up the sea from its depths. Then also appeared all those Greeks who had been routed by our stratagem in the darkness of the night and scattered through the city. They realised that our shields and weapons were not our own and did not accord with the words on our lips. In an instant they overwhelmed us by the sheer weight of their numbers. Coroebus was the first to die. He fell by the right hand of Peneleus and lay there face down on the altar of Minerva, goddess mighty in arms. Rhipeus also fell. Of all the Trojans, he was the most righteous, the greatest lover of justice. But the gods made their own judgments. Hipparnes and Dymas were cut down by their fellow Trojans. And as for you, Panthus, you found as you fell that your great devotion and the ribbon you wore as priest of Apollo were no protection. I call to witness the ashes of Troy. I call upon the flames in which my people died. In the hour of your fall, I did not flinch from the weapons of the Greeks or from anything they could do. If it had been my fate to fall, my right hand fully earned it. From here, we were swept along in the fighting, Iphitus and Peleas with me. Iphitus was no longer young, and Peleas had been slowed by a wound he had received from Ulysses. The noise of shouting drew us straight to Priam's palace, and there we found the fighting so heavy that it seemed there were no battles anywhere else, that this was the only place in the city where men were dying. We saw Mars, the irresistible god of war, Greeks rushing to the palace, men with shields locked over their backs, packing the threshold, ladders hooked to the walls, and men struggling to climb them right against the very doorposts, thrusting up their shields on their left arms to protect themselves, while their right hands gripped the top of the walls. The Trojans, for their part, were tearing down their towers and the roofs of all their buildings. They saw the end was near. And these were the weapons they were preparing to defend themselves with in the very moment of death, rolling down on the heads of their enemies the gilded beams and richly ornamented ceilings of their ancestors. Down on the ground, others were standing shoulder to shoulder with drawn swords blocking the doorway. My spirit was renewed, and I rushed to bring relief to the palace of my king, to help its defenders, to put heart into men who were defeated. There was a forgotten entrance at the rear, a secret doorway entering into a passage which joined the different parts of Priam's palace. While the kingdom of Troy still stood, poor Andromache often used to come this way unattended to visit Hector's parents, taking her son Astyanax to see his grandfather, King Priam. I slipped through this door and climbed to the highest gable of the roof, from where the doomed Trojans were vainly hurling missiles. There was a tower rising sheer towards the stars from the top of the palace roof, from which we used to look out over the whole of Troy, the Greek fleet, and the camp of the Achaeans. We set about this tower and worked round it with iron bars where there was a join we could open up above the top floor of the palace. Having loosened it from its deep bed in the walls, we rocked it and suddenly sent it toppling, spreading instant destruction and crushing great columns of Greeks. But others still came on, and the hail of rocks and other missiles never slackened. In the portico in front of the palace, on the very threshold, Pyrrhus, son of Achilles, whom men also call Neoptolemus, was rampaging, and the light flashed on the bronze of his weapons. He was like a snake which has fed on poisonous herbs and hidden all winter in the cold earth. But now it emerges into the light, casts its slough, and is renewed. Glistening with youth, it coils its slithering back and lifts its breast high to the sun with its triple tongue flickering from its mouth. Huge Periphas was with him, and Automedon, the charioteer and armor-bearer of Achilles. With him, too, were all the young warriors of Scyros coming to attack the palace and throwing firebrands onto the roof. Pyrrhus himself, at their head, seized a double-headed axe and with it smashed the hard stone of the threshold, wrenching the bronze-plated doorposts from their sockets. He then hacked a panel out of the mighty timbers of the door and broke a gaping hole, which gave them a view into the house. There, before their eyes, were the long colonnades and the inner chambers. There, before their eyes, was the heart of the palace of Priam and the ancient kings. They saw armed men standing in the doorway, but inside all was confusion and lamentation. And deep into the house the hollow chambers rang with the wailing of women, and their cries rose to strike the golden stars. Frightened mothers were wandering through the great palace, clinging to the doorposts and kissing them. But Pyrrhus pressed on with all the violence of his father Achilles, and no bolts or guards could hold him. The door gave way under repeated battering, and the posts he had dislodged from their sockets fell to the ground. Brute force made the breach, and the Greeks went storming through, butchering the guards who stood in their way, and filling the whole house with soldiers. No river foaming in spate was ever like this, bursting its banks and leaving its channel to overwhelm everything in its path with its swirling current, as it bears down furiously on ploughed fields in a great wave, and cattle and their pens are swept all over the plains. I myself saw Neoptolemus in an orgy of killing, and both the sons of Atreus on the threshold. I saw Hecuba, the queen, with 100 women, her daughters and the wives of her sons. I saw Priam's blood all over the altar, polluting the flame which he himself had sanctified. Down fell the 50 bedchambers with all the hopes for generations yet to come. And down came the proud doorposts with their spoils of barbaric gold. Everything not claimed by fire was now held by the Greeks. Perhaps you may also ask how Priam died. When he saw the capture and fall of his city, the doors of his palace torn down, and his enemy in the innermost sanctuary of his home, although he could achieve nothing, the old man buckled his armour, long unused, on shoulders trembling with age, girt on his feeble sword, and made for the thick of the fight, looking for his death. In the middle of the palace, under the naked vault of heaven, there stood a great altar, and nearby an ancient laurel tree leaning over it and enfolding the household gods in its shade. Here, vainly embracing the images of the gods, Hecuba, the queen, and her daughters were sitting flocked round the altar, like doves driven down in a black storm. When Hecuba saw that Priam had now put on his youthful armour, "Oh, my poor husband," she cried, "this is madness. Why have you put on this armour? Where can you go? This is not the sort of help we need. You are not the defender we are looking for. Not even my Hector, if he were here now. Just come here and sit by me. This altar will protect us all, or you will die with us." As she spoke, she took the old man to her and led him to a place by the holy altar. Suddenly, Polites, one of Priam's sons, came in sight. He had escaped death at the hands of Pyrrhus, and now, wounded and with enemy weapons on every side, he was running through the long porticos of the palace and across the empty halls, with Pyrrhus behind him in full cry, almost within reach, pressing him hard with his spear and poised to strike. As soon as he reached his father and mother, he fell and vomited his life's blood before their eyes. There was no escape for Priam. Death was now upon him, but he did not check himself or spare the anger in his voice. "As for you," he cried, "and for what you have done, if there is any power in heaven that cares for such things, may the gods pay you well. May they give you the reward you have deserved for making me see my own son dying before my eyes, for defiling a father's face with the murder of his son. You pretend that Achilles was your father, but this is not how Achilles treated his enemy Priam. He had respect for my rights as a suppliant and for the trust I placed in him. He gave me back the bloodless body of Hector for burial and allowed me to return to the city where I was king." With these words, the old man feebly threw his harmless spear. It rattled on the bronze of Pyrrhus's shield and hung there useless, sticking on the surface of the central boss. Pyrrhus then made his reply. "In that case, you will be my messenger and go to my father, son of Peleus. Let him know about my wicked deeds, and do not forget to tell him about the degeneracy of his son Neoptolemus. Now, die." As he spoke the word, he was dragging Priam to the very altar, his body trembling as it slithered through pools of his son's blood. Winding Priam's hair in his left hand, in his right he raised his sword with a flash of light and buried it to the hilt in Priam's side. So ended the destiny of Priam. This was the death that fell to his lot. He, who had once been the proud ruler over so many lands and peoples of Asia, died with Troy ablaze before his eyes and the citadel of Pergamum in ruins. His mighty trunk lay upon the shore, the head hacked from the shoulders, a corpse without a name. Then, for the first time, I knew the horror that was all about me. What was I to do? There came into my mind the image of my own dear father, Anchises. As I looked at the king who was his equal in age, breathing out his life with that cruel wound. There came into my mind also my wife Creusa, whom I had left behind, the plundering of my home, and the fate of young Iulus. I turned to look at the men fighting by my side. Exhausted, they had all deserted me, and thrown themselves from the roof, or given their suffering bodies to the flames. Now that I was alone, I caught sight of Helen keeping watch on the doors of the temple of Vesta, where she was staying quietly in hiding. The fires gave a bright light, and I was gazing all around me wherever I went. This Helen, this fury sent to be the scourge both of Troy and of her native Greece, was afraid of the Trojans, who hated her for the overthrow of their city. She was afraid the Greeks would punish her, and afraid of the wrath of the husband she had deserted, and so, hated by all, she had gone into hiding and was sitting there at the altar. The passion flared in my heart, and I longed in my anger to avenge my country even as it fell, and to exact the penalty for her crimes. So this woman will live to set eyes on Sparta and her native Mycenae again, and walk as queen in the triumph she has won? Will she see her husband, her father's home, and her children, and be attended by women of Troy and Phrygian slaves, while Priam lies dead by the sword, Troy has been put to the flames, and the shores of the land of Dardanus have sweated so much blood? This will not be. Although there is no fame worth remembering to be won by punishing a woman, and such a victory wins no praise, nevertheless, I shall win praise for blotting out this evil and exacting a punishment which is richly deserved. I shall also take pleasure in feeding the flames of vengeance and appeasing the ashes of my people. As I ran towards her, ranting and raving, my loving mother, the goddess Venus, suddenly appeared before my eyes. I had never before seen her so clearly, shining in perfect radiance through the darkness of the night. She revealed herself as a goddess, as the gods in heaven see her, in all her majesty of form and stature. As she caught my right hand and held me back, she opened her rosy lips and spoke to me. Oh, my son, what bitterness can have been enough to stir this wild anger in you? Why this raging passion? Where is all the love you used to have for me? Will you not first go and see where you have left your father, crippled with age, and find whether your wife Creusa is still alive, and your son Ascanius? The whole Greek army is prowling all around them, and they would have been carried off by the flames or slashed by the swords of the enemy, if my loving care were not defending them. It is not the hated beauty of the Spartan woman, Helen, the daughter of Tyndareus, that is overthrowing all this wealth and laying low the topmost towers of Troy. Nor is it Paris, although you all blame him. It is the gods, the cruelty of the gods. Look, for I shall tear away from all around you the dank cloud that veils your eyes and dulls your mortal vision. You are my son. Do not be afraid to do what I command you, and do not disobey me. Here, where you see shattered masonry, stone torn from stone, and waves of dust-laden smoke, Neptune has loosened the foundations with his great trident, and is shaking the walls, tearing up your whole city from the place where it is set. Here too is Juno, cruelest of all, the first to seize the Scaean gate, standing there, sword in hand, and furiously calling up the supporting columns from the ships. Now, look behind you. Tritonian Pallas, Athene, is already sitting on top of your citadel, shining out of the cloud with her terrible Gorgon, while the father of the gods himself puts heart into the Greeks and gives them strength. It is Jupiter himself who is rousing the gods against the armies of Troy. Escape, my son, escape with all haste. Put an end to your struggle. I shall not leave your side till I see you safely standing on the threshold of your father's door. She finished speaking and melted into the dense shadows of that night. And there, before my eyes, I saw the dreadful vision of the gods in all their might, the enemies of Troy. At that moment, I seemed to see the whole of Ilium settling into the flames, and Neptune's Troy toppling over from its foundations, like an ancient ash tree high in the mountains which farmers have hacked with blow upon blow of their double axes, labouring to fell it. Again and again it threatens to fall. Its foliage shudders, and its head trembles and nods until at last it succumbs to its wounds and breaks with a dying groan, spreading ruin along the ridge. I came down from the roof, and with the god to lead me, a way opened through fire and sword. The weapons parted, and the flames drew back before me. When at last I had reached the door of my father's house and our ancient home, my first wish was to find my father and take him into the high mountains. But he refused to go on living now that Troy had been levelled to the earth. He would not hear of exile, but cried, "Those of you with young blood still thick in your veins, those of you whose strength is sound and unimpaired, you are the ones who must busy yourselves with escaping. If the gods in heaven had wished me to go on living, they would have preserved this place for me. I have already seen one sack of the city and survived its capture, and that is more than enough. Here I lie, and here I stay. Take your farewells and leave me. My own right hand will earn me my death. The enemy will take pity on me. They will be looking for spoils. I shall have no tomb, but that is an easy loss to bear. For long years, ever since the father of the gods and king of men blew the wind of his thunderbolt upon me and touched me with its fire, I have been lingering here, hated by the gods and useless to men." As he said these words, he stood there rooted, and no power could move him. Streaming with tears, my wife Creusa, Ascanius, all of us, begged him not to bring everything down on his own head. When fate batters a house, the father should not add his weight to the blows. But he still refused. He stood by his decision and stayed where he was. I rushed to take up arms again in complete despair. Death was the only thing I could hope for. What course could I follow? What fate was in store for us? "Did you think I could run away and leave my father here?" I exclaimed. "How did such a sacrilege escape my father's lips? If the gods above decree that nothing of this great city is to survive, if your mind is fixed and it's your pleasure to add yourself and those you love to the destruction of the city, the door is open and the deaths you want will come. Pyrrhus will soon be here, soaked in the blood of Priam. He is the one who murders the son before the face of the father, and the father at the altar. Oh, my loving mother, is this why you took me through fire and sword, so that I could see my enemy in the innermost sanctuary of my home, and Ascanius and my father and my wife Creusa with them, lying sacrificed in each other's blood? Bring me my armour, comrades, bring it here. This is the last light we shall see, and it is calling the defeated. Give me back to the Greeks. Let me go back and rejoin the battle. Today we die, but not all of us shall die unavenged. I buckled on my sword again and was fixing my left arm into the shield. But as I was leaving, Creusa suddenly threw herself at my feet in the doorway and held me, stretching out our little son, Aeolus, towards me. If you are going to your death, she cried, take us with you to share your fate, whatever it is. But if you have reason to put any hope in arms, your first duty is to guard this house. If you leave us here, what fate is waiting for little Aeolus, for your father, and for the woman who used to be called your wife? Her cries of anguish were filling the whole house, when suddenly there was a great miracle. At the very moment when we were both holding Aeolus, and he was there between our sorrowing faces, a light began to stream from the top of the pointed cap he was wearing, and the flame seemed to lick his soft hair and feed round his forehead without harming him. We took fright and rushed to beat out the flames in his hair and quench the holy fire with water. But Father Anchises, looking joyfully up to the stars of heaven and raising his hands palms upward, lifted his voice in prayer. O all-powerful Jupiter, if ever you yield to prayers, look down upon us, that is all we ask. And if we deserve anything for our devotion, give us help at last, Father Jupiter, and confirm this omen. Scarcely had he spoken when a sudden peal of thunder rang out on the left, and a star fell from the sky, trailing a great torch of light in its course through the darkness. We watched it glide over the topmost pinnacles of the house and bury itself, still bright, in the woods of Mount Ida, leaving its path marked out behind it, a broad furrow of light, and the whole place smoked all around with sulphur. Now, at last, my father was truly convinced. He rose up and addressed the gods, praying to the sacred star. There is now no more delay. Now I follow. O gods of my fathers, wherever you lead, there am I. Preserve this house. Preserve my grandson. This is your sign. Troy is in your mighty hands. Anchises yields. I am willing to go with you, my son, and be your companion. He had spoken. The noise of the fires was growing louder and louder through the city, and the tide of flame was rolling nearer. Come then, dear father, up on my back. I shall take you on my shoulders. Your weight will be nothing to me. Whatever may come, danger or safety, it will be the same for both of us. Young Aeolus can walk by my side, and my wife can follow in my footsteps at a distance. And you, the slaves of our house, must pay attention to what I am saying. As you leave the city, there is a mound with a lonely old temple of Ceres. Near it is an ancient cypress preserved and revered for many long years by our ancestors. We shall go to that one place by different routes. You, father, take in your arms the sacraments and the ancestral gods of our home. I am fresh from all the fighting and killing, and it is not right for me to touch them till I have washed in a running stream. When I had finished speaking, I put on a tawny lion's skin as a covering for my neck and the breadth of my shoulders, and then I bowed down and took up my burden. Little Aeolus twined his fingers in my right hand and kept up with me with his short steps. Creusa walked behind us, and we moved along, keeping to the shadows. This was the man who had been unmoved by all the missiles of the Greeks, and had long faced their serried ranks without a tremor. But now every breath of wind frightened me, and I started at every sound. So anxious was I, so afraid both for the man I carried and for the child at my side. I was now coming near the gates, and it seemed that our journey was nearly over and we had escaped, when I suddenly thought I heard the sound of many marching feet, and my father, looking out through the darkness, cried, "Run, my son, run! They are coming this way. I can see the flames reflected on their shields and the bronze glinting." At that moment, some hostile power confused me and robbed me of my wits. I ran where there was no road, leaving the familiar area of the streets. Then it was that my wife Creusa was torn from me by the cruelty of fate. Whether she stopped or lost her way, or sat down exhausted, no one can tell. I never saw her again. Nor did I look behind me, or think of her, or realise that she was lost, till we arrived at the mound and the ancient sanctuary of Ceres. But when at last everyone had gathered there, she was the only one who was not with us, and neither her companions, nor her son, nor her husband knew how she had been lost. I stormed and raged and blamed every god and man that ever was. This was the cruelest thing I saw in all the sack of the city. Leaving Ascanius, my father, and the gods of Troy with my companions, and hiding them all away in a winding valley, I put on my flashing armour and went back to the city, resolved to face all its dangers again, to go back through the whole of Troy, and once more put my life at peril. First, I went back to the walls and the dark gateway by which I had left the city. I found my route and retraced it, gazing all around me through the darkness. Horror was everywhere, and the very silence chilled the blood. Then I went on to our house, thinking it was possible, just possible, that she had gone there. The Greeks had come, flooding in, and were everywhere. Consuming flames, fanned by the winds, were soon rolling to the top of the roof and leaping above it as their hot breath raged at the sky. From there, I went on to Priam's palace, and the citadel where Phoenix and the terrible Ulysses, who had been chosen to keep watch, were already guarding the loot in the empty porticos of the shrine of Juno. Here, Greeks were piling up the treasures of Troy, pillaged from all the burning temples, the tables of the gods, mixing bowls of solid gold, and all the robes they had plundered. Children and frightened mothers stood around in long lines. I even dared to call her name into the darkness, filling the streets with my shouts. Grief-stricken I called her name, "Creusa! Creusa!" Again and again. There was no answer. I would not give up the search, but was still rushing around the houses of the city, when her likeness appeared in sorrow before my eyes, her very ghost, but larger than she was in life. I was paralysed. My hair stood on end, my voice stuck in my throat. Then she spoke to me, and comforted my sorrow with these words, "Oh, husband that I love, why do you choose to give yourself to such wild grief? These things do not happen without the approval of the gods. It is not their will that Creusa should go with you when you leave this place. The king of High Olympus does not allow it. Before you lies a long exile and a vast expanse of sea to plough before you come to the land of Hesperia, where the Lydian River Tibris flows with smooth advance through a rich land of brave warriors. There, prosperity is waiting for you, and a kingdom, and a royal bride. Wipe away the tears you are shedding for Creusa, whom you loved. I shall not have to see the proud palaces of the Myrmidons and Dolopians. I am a daughter of Dardanus, and my husband was the son of Venus, and I shall never go to be a slave to any matron of Greece. The great mother of the gods keeps me here in this land of Troy. Now, fare you well. Do not fail in your love for our son. She spoke and faded into the insubstantial air, leaving me there in tears and longing to reply. Three times I tried to put my arms around her neck. Three times her phantom melted in my arms, as weightless as the wind, as light as the flight of sleep. By now, the night was over. I returned to my comrades without her. Here, I found that new companions had streamed in, and I was amazed at the numbers of them, men and women, an army collected for exile. A pitiable crowd. They had come from all directions, ready to follow me, with all their resources and all their hearts, to whatever land I should wish to lead them. And now, Lucifer, the morning star, was rising above the ridges of Mount Ida and bringing on the day. The Greeks were on guard at the gates, and there was no hope of helping the city. I yielded. I lifted up my father and set out for the mountains.